MechCast, Tuesday, October 11th, 2016. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I hope you are having a good week. Mine's been a little bit rough. We're not going to get into that because we don't do that on this show. But just know that I am happy to be sitting down with you and recording this episode. Getting away, talking a little bit about what's going on with Apple and Macs and things like that. Nothing serious going on in my life, so you don't have to get worried. I know sometimes when I say these things, you guys worry a little bit, and I really appreciate that. It's just one of the great things I love about this community. But I'm all fine. Just little personal things happening that are just frustrating. And we all have those in our lives, I think. So you are my therapy for getting through that. Glad to be sitting down here with you. Like I said, we've got a ton of things to talk about. This is going to be another big show. It's been a little while since we talked, so that kind of happens. The stories build up. There's things I want to mention to you. In the news, we're going to be talking about maybe some new Mac Pros finally around the corner. I know we've been talking about it a lot, but it may actually be happening this time around. Q4 results for Apple coming up. We're going to talk about what that's looking like. Some news about Apple Watch, AirPods, maybe some new iPad Pros, Apple working on some iCloud things, whole international news roundup, a little bit of odds and ends, and then there's this whole incident with Apple and a developer that you may or may not have caught up on. I'm going to talk about that, try to explain things because there's confusing things going across on both sides, and we'll dig into that a little bit. I'll give you my thoughts and opinions. And of course, we got a lot of great feedback, a little update on the whole Fujitsu Mac OS Sierra thing, some feedback on two-factor authentication. Also, you shared many of your thoughts with me on the iPhone 7 upgrade. And then I've got some tips and tricks, some things with photos and digital touch. And then rounding it out, I have a pretty cool thing of the moment for you this week. So that's going to be the show. Like I said, lots of things to jump into and cover. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Hover. And I have to tell you, I absolutely love having Hover as a sponsor because I've been a Hover customer for years. Many of you know that in addition to podcasting, I also build websites for other people, for myself. And I can tell you, I've dealt with just about every domain name registration company there is. Like, you name it, I've probably head to work with them. And I chose Hover for my domains. And you know why? It really comes down to one word: simplicity. They focus on helping you find and get the perfect domain name. It's not all they do, but it is the main focus. And it really shows they're dedicated to doing just that. And they do an excellent job. I never thought I would say this, it's absolutely true. I love my domain name company. And Hover, of course, knows that it's not just about finding the perfect domain name. You also need to be able to use it, and they have tools to help you with that, too. With Hover, it's incredibly easy to set up your domain name with the most popular website builders. You can use their Hover Connect to set up your domain automatically in just a few clicks. So you don't have to be a domain guru. You don't have to get in there and do a bunch of DNS configuration. The tool is going to handle it for you. You don't have to dive into the documentation, a bunch of screenshots, and figure out how to, you know, work your way through your provider's control panel and stuff like that to set all that stuff up. Hover is going to take care of you. They've got your back. And that's what it's all about. Again, simplicity, making the whole process easy. And once you've tried Hover, I think you're going to love them so much that you're going to want to have all your domains with them. I know that's exactly what happened to me. And of course, they make that easy to do as well. Plus, they have volume discounts. So the more domains you have on the same account, you're going to save money. And all eligible domains get a free Whois privacy. And if you don't know what that is your domain registration information. Anybody can look that up unless it's private. And a lot of places will charge you for that. It comes free with eligible domains on Hover. So just another great part of that service. They're going to protect your personal information, keep that safe and away from spammers and hackers and all of those people. So I really want you to give them a try for your next domain name or move your existing domains to Hover today. Go to hover.com, that's H-O-V-E-R.com, and when you check out, be sure to use the promo code MACCAST3, M-A-C-C-A-S-T-3. Do that at checkout, and you're going to save 10% off your first purchase. Big thank you to Hover for their support of the MACCAST. Will we finally see some new Mac hardware soon, specifically these MacBook Pros? There's still rumblings out there that Apple could update the MacBook Pro lineup, and it could happen this month, toward the end of the month. Mac Rumors says their sources claim that a lot of work is being done in macOS Sierra 10.12.1, the update that's going to support the major new feature that many are expecting in that MacBook Pro, and we've talked about this, that OLED touch bar that's going to replace the function bars. Also, there's rumors that we may be getting some new GPUs, and Apple's been tweaking the software for that as well, at least according to Mac Rumors. Now, the OLED touch bar is said to be dynamic. They're going to be able to have apps kind of change the functionality of that touch bar. And again, it's a touch bar, so of course it's touch sensitive. And it's allegedly also going to have Touch ID integration up there. So for doing web purchases and other purchases online, you'll be able to actually use your fingerprint, also fingerprint for login, all of that other great stuff that we have with our iOS devices. So this is kind of a major upgrade for the MacBook Pro. And on the higher end 15-inch models, they're supposedly going to get new discrete Polaris graphics chips from AMD. So the latest GPU technology coming as well. And the hope is that 10.12.1 will soon be clearing beta testing so that it actually can be shipped out to suppliers for preloading on those new MacBook Pro models, which Apple hopes to ship supposedly before the end of the month. Now, I thought there was going to be some sort of special event, some sort of announcement. We don't really know if that's going to happen exactly. It may just be a quiet rollout. But I'm thinking Apple's going to want to do this. And there's some evidence that some people think is pointing to Apple actually having an event for these new models. Some other things that are being expected out of the new MacBook Pro is a new design, supposedly thinner, not going to be wedge-shaped like the MacBook Air, but thinner than the current lineup. And it will also feature a move, I think this seems logical, to USB-C ports from the current USB port. Now, the question will be, are they going to still maintain and still have a Thunderbolt port, or are we going to get Thunderbolt 3 over the USB-C connector? I'm thinking it's going to be the latter, but that's just my personal opinion. We also are still continuing to hear reports as well of a rumored Apple LG 5K display, though the time on that, if it actually is a thing, is unclear, so that may or may not happen with this event. And unfortunately, as far as the Macs go, it's looking like the MacBook Pro is the only thing we're really hearing about being updated. Maybe possibly some new MacBook Airs, although I'm not putting much stock in that because I think the MacBook Air lineup is kind of done. If they're making the MacBook Pro line thinner, I think they can build out that lineup, have a lower priced model on the 13-inch side, and probably fill in the gaps. I'm not seeing a lot of room being left for the MacBook Air. But there are some rumors saying that Apple may give us an update of new MacBook Airs with USB-C ports. So those could be at this event as well. But as far as other Macs, nothing on the Mac Pro, nothing on the Mac Mini at this time. We're not hearing anything related to those two models. And it's interesting because I had a conversation with some people recently about the theory that maybe, as far as desktop Macs go, the iMac could become the exclusive model for Apple, and they could have entry-level models that kind of fill in where the Mac Mini sits right now at a lower price point. I don't think they could get them down as low as the Mac Mini price point, but probably can get them in that sub-$1,000 range. I think we already have them there, as a matter of fact. And then also on the higher end, you could kind of fill in the Mac Pro. And I know a lot of pros who are using that 27-inch 5K iMac in lieu of the actual Mac Pro Tower. Now, I know they're not kind of in the same league, but for a lot of applications, for a lot of Apple customers, this kind of makes sense. So I don't know. What do you think on that? Do you think we could be whittling our way down to just the iMac as Apple's only full-size desktop Mac? And then we'll have the MacBook Pro line and the MacBook line as the notebook lineup. I think simplifying the lineup like that might make a lot of sense. Otherwise, if they're not going to do that, they need to do something at least with the Mac Pro lineup. I know a lot of professionals out there, and I've heard from you, are getting very frustrated. That thing's 3 years old. It's well overdue, way, way overdue for an update. So Apple needs to either make a move on that or just tell us it's end of life. It's done. But they need to make a statement on the Mac Pro for sure. The Mac Mini, I don't really know. It's one of my personal favorites, so I'd feel sad to see it go away. I'd love to see them do an update. They don't have to do it, you know, frequently, but a little bit of love for the Mac Mini would be great. But again, it wouldn't surprise me if they decide, nope, you know, that's no longer part of the lineup. Now, Bloomberg spotted something interesting. A couple job listings from NVIDIA that mentioned applicants would, quote, help produce the next revolutionary Apple products. And that's interesting because currently most Apple products that have GPUs, dedicated GPUs, are using AMD technology. So the question becomes, is this a sign that they're going to switch soon? And Apple has switched back and forth over the years, but AMD has been kind of their GPU partner for a while now. Now, the listing also notes that applicants must have experience or should have experience with Apple's Metal graphics technology. So that seems to point to a higher-end model or maybe something on the mobile side, although for their mobile chipsets, Apple uses PowerVR. Again, they can always kind of change that technology, change up the designs a little bit. But something might be going on with Apple and NVIDIA. Now, don't expect the NVIDIA tech to show up in this updated MacBook Pro because this job listing just went out. So they're hiring right now. So it'd be at least a year or two out. And it's already rumored, as I mentioned earlier, that Apple's probably using the Polaris graphics chips from AMD for this MacBook Pro update. But still, a little bit of interesting news on Apple shaking up the GPU side of their Macs. And then the lack of new Macs right now might be having somewhat of an impact on Apple's Mac sales numbers. Two sources released numbers this week, both Gartner and IDC. On the Gartner side of the numbers, they say that in the third quarter of 2016, worldwide sales numbers, their estimates are that Apple sold just under 5 million Macs. That would be down about 13.4% from the 5.4 million they sold in the third quarter of 2015. Overall, they say PC shipments in general fell 5.7%, so Apple is doing considerably worse than the overall market at this point. They also lost some of their market share, moving from 7.3% worldwide to 6.7% of the worldwide PC market. But they did maintain their position as the fifth largest PC vendor. Now, IDC also released numbers similar to Gartner's, estimating that Apple, again, sold 5 million Macs in the quarter, and they noted that would be down 13%, though they only estimated about a 3.9% decline for the overall PC market. So it kind of makes Apple's performance in this last quarter look worse. Now, of course, Apple hasn't had any new Mac offerings for people to buy into, so that's probably reflecting in these numbers. And certainly, new MacBook Pros and possibly MacBook Airs could help with that. And anything else, iMacs, Mac Pros, Mac Minis, all of these things moving into the last quarter of the year, moving into the fourth quarter, could considerably help Apple's numbers in this area. But until they give us new Macs, we're really not going to know. But that's kind of the latest that's going on the Mac side of Apple's business. Now, speaking of quarters and quarterly results, Apple's Q4 results call has been rescheduled and moved, which is interesting. Apple originally scheduled its fourth quarter 2016 earnings call for October 27th, but bumped it up 2 days to the 25th due to what they're calling scheduling conflicts. Now, some are speculating, as I mentioned earlier, that the conflict could actually be a MacBook Pro event or announcement. And I guess the idea here is that the numbers for Q4 are probably not going to look too positive. So having the MacBook Pro event, which is probably going to be a very huge thing for Apple media-wise, and there's a lot of excitement and buzz, again, around this OLED touch bar MacBook Pro, that could kind of deflect away from some of the soft Q4 numbers for Apple. So will that happen? We won't really know until we see some invites going out, but sounds plausible to me. The results will cover the quarterly period ending in September, so it will include some of the early iPhone 7 series sales numbers. The iPhone 7s, you remember, began pre-orders on September 9th, so you have, what, about 3 weeks in there for those numbers to be accounted for. The bummer is we won't really know actual numbers because Apple does not break out sales by model, so we'll just kind of have iPhone as a category, but of course that won't stop analysts from speculating. Now, some analysts have predicted a 10% year-over-year drop in iPhone sales, but it's looking like they may actually be more in line with the iPhone 6 series sales just based on demand for the iPhone 7, and we'll talk about that a little bit more here in a second. And of course, we're also going to have new Apple Watch Series 2, Series 1, and Series 2 numbers in there. But again, remember, those numbers are rolled up in what Apple calls their other category with Beats headphones and iPods and all those things. So again, we're going to have to kind of extrapolate a little bit to try and figure out how well did Apple Watch do, how well did iPhone 7 do. But I'm sure we'll get analysts really looking into those numbers and trying to break those out based on other data that they get. And when we have those numbers, we can talk about them a little bit more. But it's expected that it's going to look better than I think a lot of people had originally predicted. As far as what Apple has said they're predicting, they expect revenues of $45.5 to $47.5 billion, which is considerably lower than the $51.5 billion they generated in the same quarter a year ago. So again, numbers are expected to decline a little bit. It's not going to be any big surprise. The question is going to be, how much have they declined? Getting back to those iPhones, though, something that is sort of indicating that the numbers might be a little bit more positive is there's reports from DigiTimes that iPhone 7 component orders are supposedly increasing for the end of the year. So Apple trying to catch up with demand. DigiTimes says screen orders are up 20 to 30%, or they're 20 to 30% higher than originally thought. Estimates are that Apple may produce between 80 to 84 million iPhone 7 units this year. That's just slightly under the 85 to 90 million iPhone 6S units that were produced in 2016. So again, those numbers are very close to each other, closer than many people had expected. And that could be a good thing because recent checks of Apple Store inventory across the U.S. are showing that there's still 3 weeks after launch, almost 4 weeks after launch at this point, still almost next to impossible to get your hands on an iPhone 7 Plus, especially if you want that one in jet black or black, especially if you want the ones that are in the larger storage sizes. Even iPhone 7s are a little bit hard to come by. So stores are getting daily inventory, or they claim they're getting daily inventory, but supposedly selling out in a matter of minutes. And I would have to say, with Samsung announcing just today, as I'm recording this show, that they're discontinuing sales of the Note 7 due to all the problems they've been having, it's probably going to get even harder to get your hands, especially on an iPhone 7 Plus, because everybody wants those larger phones. And they don't just want those larger phones, they also want those new glossy black ones. Like I've been saying recently, jet black is the new white. Remember when we had a hard time getting our hands on that new white iPhone? Yeah, same thing going on here. And as a matter of fact, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo says that the jet black model is currently accounting for up to 35% of all iPhone 7 sales. And because of that, he's making some predictions about what Apple might do for the next generation iPhone in 2017. He believes that in 2017, the iPhone is going to use a more scratch-resistant all-glass front and back design with a stainless steel edge, at least on the premium models. So Apple still having a metal frame. I think that metal frame is going to be somewhat minimized. I think they're going to use a curved glass on the front and back. We've been hearing about this desire for Johnny Ive, that Johnny Ive has to do this all-glass iPhone design. And the stainless steel edge on the premium model is said to kind of match the design of the stainless steel Apple Watch, a little more premium material. And again, the glass would give it more scratch resistance. And also that metal frame, just the rigidity or structure that you need for all of those components and things like that, rather than being all glass front and back, like some of the other rumors have alluded to. Now, they're saying Apple, or Quo, I guess, rather, is saying that Apple is more likely to stick with a slightly curved, what they call a 2.5D cover glass on the 2017 iPhone. Same kind of curvature that we see in the iPhone 6S, rather than fully adopt a 3D design. This is in light of mass production considerations and, I guess, drop test performance. So having less of a curve, a 2.5D cover glass, supposedly is better, more easy to produce, and performs better in drop testings. And I have to say, you know, with the metal edge, if the it could be finished in the same method that they did for the jet black iPhone, I would imagine with the edge of the glass on front and back and a maybe thinner metal frame, it could almost be blended so that it was completely seamless. So Johnny could get that look where it looks just like a single sheet of glass, even with that metal frame in there. So this kind of rumor is making sense to me. And the argument for glass is that it would give that glossy look of the jet black model, but again, be more resistant to scratches. Because you remember one of the things that happened when the jet black model was announced is people noticed in an Apple Tech article that there could be micro abrasions that happen on that surface. And some people have already noted that in their reviews. They say it's very minimal. Most people aren't going to notice it. But if you look very closely, you'll see those sorts of things. And Apple really recommends putting a case on it if you think that's going to bother you. But if it's all glass, then that would be more resistant. The concern, though, of course, is going to be it's going to be infinitely more crackable, right? You're not going to want to drop that thing. But glass has gotten better. And if you've seen the drop tests, even for the new iPhone 7 models, they're incredibly resilient. So next generation glass, maybe it's finally time that Apple can actually do it. As far as sizes go, he thinks Apple's going to stick with the 4.7 and 5.5-inch sizes. And other sources have been predicting this radical design change. They're saying for the 10th anniversary edition of the iPhone, Apple moving to an OLED display, edge-to-edge design, concealing in the Touch ID sensor and the home button, all on that single front piece of glass, so you're no longer going to have the actual bump or ridge. It's actually going to be all integrated and touch. And I even heard or saw some rumors that were saying Apple would hide the speaker grill and the camera under the glass, although I don't know, or the earpiece grill rather, under the glass. I don't know how that would work for actually hearing stuff through the phone. I'm guessing there would have to still be a slot there, but maybe it's just going to be under the glass with, or under the display with the display kind of wrapping around that little hole. That could be a little bit weird. I'm not really sure. I'm trying to picture in my mind how that all would work, but that was one of the other rumors that I saw discussed this week. I found a little bit interesting. And as far as that display goes, that OLED display, Apple hasn't moved to that technology yet because of production yield issues. Just the volume of displays that Apple would need and the quality kind of has limited them from moving to that technology. Also, the cost a little bit. But everyone's thinking in 2017, that's going to be the year for Apple to switch, although it could be brief. We talked about the micro LED technology that they may move to the following year. They have some R&D taking place in that. I think they have some factories throughout the world that are working on that technology for Apple. But for now, OLED looks like the technology that they're going to go with. And Sharp Display, which is an Apple supplier currently and is now owned by Apple iPhone manufacturer Foxconn, they announced plans to invest $568 million into their OLED business. And Apple is supposedly in talks with Sharp about supplying them with future OLED panels. And you might think all of this helps support the theory that Apple is going to make this switch to OLED for the iPhone next year, but probably not, because Sharp plans to apply this investment sometime between April and June of 2018. So any of the talks that Apple's having right now is probably for future displays, and maybe hedging their bets in case the micro LED technology doesn't come forward. But there have been prior reports that Sharp would be shipping OLED panels to customers before the end of 2017. That's probably using their existing production facilities and equipment. So it's unknown, you know, what kind of timeline would fit in for Apple and what kind of volume. So they may just be one supplier in a group of suppliers for Apple's OLED panels. So the question is, you know, again, will Sharp have enough OLED capacity to supply panels for the 2017 iPhone? And why the switch? We talked about this a little bit, but just a quick reminder, OLEDs have the advantage of thinness. You can make them thinner because you don't need the backlight layer. They have better power efficiency, higher contrast, better refresh rates, they're brighter, and they can be curved, which would be ideal if Apple is going with a curved glass design in the 2017 model of the iPhone. The disadvantage is yield rates are generally not as good as LED, and the price point's a little bit higher. But 2017 is looking like the year of the OLED iPhone. And then one last thing kind of related to next-gen iPhone, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation says that their 10-nanometer chip production technology is going to be ready by the end of the year. And that's pretty amazing because it's actually going to beat Intel to that technology by almost a year. TSMC's CEO said their R&D is already working on a 5-nanometer process, hoping to eventually push the technology down to 2 nanometers. So they are moving very, very quickly. To put all that into comparison and kind of give you a reference, TSMC currently builds the iPhone 7's A10 Fusion chip, and that is using a 14-nanometer technology. And it's expected that they are going to be building the A11 for the 2017 iPhone. So I would fully expect that chip to probably use this new 10-nanometer technology that they're getting ready to introduced by the end of this year. So again, probably some amazing technology in that 10th anniversary iPhone, including a new A11 chip. So that's the latest with iPhone. If you've had your eye on a new Apple Watch and your insurance company is Aetna, or your employer's insurance provider is Aetna, you're about to get very excited. And if you're an Aetna employee, you may even be more excited, because the insurance company Aetna announced that it will be giving Apple Watches to its nearly 50,000 employees as part of a wellness reimbursement program. They also announced a program for large employers and individual customers where they said they're going to subsidize a, quote, significant portion of the Apple Watch cost and offer monthly payroll deductions to cover the remaining amount. So you're going to be able to get a subsidized Apple Watch. Now, they didn't give a specific amount of the subsidy, so that's a little bit in question, and they didn't give any details on specifically which Apple Watch models would be covered. But I would assume that if it's just a subsidy, you're probably going to get an allowance and then be able to apply that, hopefully, to whatever Apple Watch model you want. But we don't have details on that, but still, they announced the program. And customers will have the opportunity to take advantage of the program during the open enrollment season this fall. So if you are an Aetna customer or you have a provider, your insurance provider through your employer is Aetna, you may want to wait a little bit if you were thinking about buying a new Apple Watch, because you might be able to get in on this program. Now, the company said that they're getting support from Apple as well to develop several iOS health initiatives, and that they will also be debuting with deeply integrated health apps for the iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch that will be available to all Aetna customers. Now, Aetna claims the apps will be designed to, quote unquote, simplify the healthcare process and offer features like care management to help guide customers through new diagnoses or medication, medication reminders and tools for making getting refills easier, and also integration with Apple Wallet for paying their bills and checking up on their deductibles. And the only thing about this, it sounds great, but the only thing about this is I wonder if the data sharing and or use of the Aetna apps would be required for receiving this Apple Watch subsidy. Are you going to be able to take advantage of the program if you don't opt into sort of using these apps and allowing the kind of data collection? And are they, I guess another question would be, are they going to be doing data collection for this stuff? The idea, you know, if that is the case, the idea of giving up health data to your health insurance provider might be a little bit scary. Sounds a little bit scary to me. I mean, that's kind of information that you'd think they might generally use to up your deductibles. I guess if you remain healthy and you're doing your exercise and stuff like that, maybe you also get the advantage of getting your deductibles lowered. But it gets into this little dicey area. And considering Apple is so on top of customers' privacy, especially when it comes to healthcare data and things like that, you know, and Apple is a partner with Aetna on this, you know, it's going to be interesting to hear some of the specific details on exactly how this program is working. But, you know, if it's not too nefarious, this could be a great way to get an Apple Watch at a reduced cost. And again, if you're an Aetna employee, you're likely getting a new Apple Watch for free, which is kind of pretty cool. A few other things on Apple Watch, or one other thing on Apple Watch. Despite getting new models out there, and the Apple Watch is kind of getting a lot of positive press, the Series 2, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that year-over-year Apple Watch sales are going to be down a little bit. He says Apple Watch sales are going to be down 15 to 25%, with Apple selling between 8.5 to 9 million units in 2016. And why does he think that? Well, the main reason he gives, he thinks that battery life not really improving means that a lot of people aren't really interested in upgrading or maybe buying a new Apple Watch, and that the dependency that the Apple Watch still has on the iPhone is slowing things down a little bit, and the lack of a quote-unquote killer app for Apple Watch is keeping consumers from getting overly excited about Apple Watch. And so he doesn't think that the sales numbers are going to reflect any kind of excitement or uptick in Apple Watch sales. And I, you know, I can kind of see that. The killer app thing, I think, is really specific to the type of person. I would argue that health and fitness is probably a killer app, and people who are into that, I know a lot of them have Apple Watches and are very excited, actually, about the new Apple Watch, specifically the two features being GPS functionality and the waterproof, being able to do swimming workouts. So in that category, I think Apple Watch Series 2 is probably doing very, very well. But the question becomes, is it enough to kind of see an uptick in Apple Watch sales? Kuo doesn't think so. He also doesn't think that the updated lower price Apple Watch Series 1 is going to help out either. Although I think that's actually a pretty exciting option for a lot of people. You can save a little bit of money and get kind of the latest and greatest technology minus the GPS stuff. But I think if you're looking at an Apple Watch, consider Apple Watch Series 1 if you don't need the GPS kind of functionality. But you know, I think smartwatches in general, Apple is continuing to kind of be on the top of the curve in terms of smartwatch manufacturers. I think they're going to stay there. The question is this going to become a category that's really going to grow year over year? And I would agree with Kuo. Until the Apple Watch is truly autonomous, until it does truly have really great apps running on it. It has good apps today. There's a lot of interesting and neat things you can do with it. But, I think that's right. There's not a huge need for an Apple Watch, especially if you have a smartphone or some other device. So that makes sense. And I'd love to hear what you think about this. You know, you think he's right on? Do you think that's kind of what's happening with Apple Watch? And also, what do you think about this whole Aetna program? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Now, this next story is a little bit interesting to me because it's about the AirPods and some data that's showing that a lot of people are really excited about Apple's new wireless earbuds. And for me, when Apple first announced them, I wasn't all that excited about them. But to be honest, I probably fall in this group. I'm getting more and more excited about the AirPods. And so Bank of America Merrill Lynch did a survey that showed that 12% of U.S. consumers were planning on buying AirPods. That is a huge number. You know, at $159 a pop, that could potentially net Apple about $3 billion in revenue from a set of AirPods. Not bad. You know, wireless earbuds, $3 billion. That would be amazing. And the same survey also noted that only a small portion of respondents who own what they called a Watch Series 1, about 8% of those respondents said they intended to buy an Apple Watch Series 2. And I would say that kind of makes sense. Again, if you have an Apple Watch, you're happy with it, and it's the original Apple Watch. Remember, Apple Watch Series 1 is actually a new product. There's not a lot of reason to upgrade, so that kind of makes sense. But the AirPod thing is pretty amazing to me, and I think that just shows that there's some buzz and excitement around that technology. And I'm thinking of it, I'd like to have it around more as a Siri interface than necessarily a music listening device. And I may end up getting a set of AirPods. I wasn't that excited about them at first, but I'm getting more and more excited. I don't know about you. Are the AirPods going to be a bigger deal than maybe we originally thought? Chime in. Give me your opinion. Maccast@gmail.com. Coming from the Japanese blog Mac Atakara, a source that has mixed results with Apple rumors, they claim that Apple is going to announce new iPad Pro models this spring. They say that there's actually going to be three different models coming from Apple. They, according to the site, the 12.9-inch model is going to get the same True Tone display technology as its smaller but newer 9.7-inch sister. It will also adopt, according to them, the 12-megapixel camera from the 9.7-inch model. In addition to that, the report claims that Apple will introduce a whole new size, a 7.9-inch. Well, I guess it's not a new size because it's actually the iPad mini size, but iPad Mini Pro, or just the 7.9-inch iPad Pro model, and that will actually replace the current iPad Mini 4. It will have similar specs to its larger siblings, but be in a smaller package. So that would include the smart connector, True Tone display, quad speakers, 12 megapixel camera with the True Tone flash, and they don't mention this specifically, but I would assume also Apple Pencil support. I know a lot of people who really like the 7.9-inch form factor and really would like to see Apple have a model that has Apple Pencil support in that size. So that could be good news if you've been looking for that. Finally, they say that the 9.7-inch model is actually going to get a little bit bigger, coming in at 10.1 inches, rounding out the three-tier iPad Pro lineup for 2017. Additionally, they say that all three models will add quad microphones, supposedly for better Siri support, and many people will be happy to hear this, will keep the 3.5-millimeter headphone jack. Although that seems odd to me. If Apple is ditching the 3.5-millimeter jack on the iPhone, why wouldn't they do that on the iPad? I guess one argument is that they have more space available on the iPad, and that was reportedly one of the reasons why they wanted to dump it from the iPhone. But I think moving forward, Apple is got their laser sights set on the 3.5 millimeter jack. And, you know, if you're going to do something, you might as well just do it across the board. In my opinion, Apple's done that in the past. I don't see them changing now, but could be there, could not be there. And we'll just have to wait and see what Apple actually does in the spring. And these rumors do kind of jive with an earlier reports from Ming-Chi Kuo, although he claimed there was going to be a new 10.5-inch Pro model plus a low-cost 9.7-inch and did not specifically mention anything like an iPad Pro Mini. But certainly timing seems right, so if you're looking for a new iPad, probably going to have to wait till spring of 2017. Apple is working on its cloud. Of course, they're always working on their cloud, but what we've heard more recently is that Apple is going to be unifying its cloud services team. Now, you would have thought they had done this a long time ago, but they really hadn't. I guess a lot of the teams have been working through or in different offices spread out through space in Cupertino and Sunnyvale, different buildings that Apple has there. Now they're saying that Apple plans to bring all of those teams, Siri, Apple Maps, iCloud, Apple Pay, Apple News, and parts of iTunes and Apple Music, to bring them all under one roof, kind of unifying those teams together. And they're going to do it at the Infinite Loop headquarters in Cupertino. The hope is that having everyone finally on one campus is going to help streamline growth of Apple services, helping to eliminate bugs and speed up the development process, something I think we could all agree we would all benefit from, not just Apple's team. The report mentions a project also codenamed Pi that plans to move all of the services onto Apple to an Apple-made back-end system. Again, the idea here is that it will give Apple more control and ability to kind of speed up and improve the system. They've reportedly already started moving parts of Siri and the iTunes Store and Apple News to the new platform, with hopes to move other services like Maps to the new system over the next few years. And if you remember a while back, we had talked about a project from Apple, a reported project from Apple services project called McQueen. The idea there was that Apple was taking all of their photo storage, moving that in-house onto systems that they designed and built. And Apple is reportedly doing all of this to reduce its dependency on outside services from companies like Amazon Web Services, Microsoft Azure, and Google's cloud platform, all technologies that they're currently using to drive their cloud. So Apple wanting to exert more control over that, something that Apple likes to do with all of their technologies. I guess they figure with their new data centers going in worldwide that they will have much more ability to kind of control that themselves, and they want to bring it in-house and under one roof. And I think that is a good plan ultimately for all of us, especially if they can really improve their cloud services. A few weeks back, I kind of introduced a little new segment on the MacCast, and I told you I often have little news stories that are international Apple news stories, and they kind of don't fit into maybe some of the other categories. They tend to be short little blurbs and things like that, and I thought maybe we can put these into a little international news roundup. And I asked you, you know, would you like to have more of this? And I got a lot of great feedback, and many of you said, absolutely, yes. I kind of like that thing. I like getting some of these international stories. So we're going to cover a few of those here this week. We've got several of them, starting off with a story out of the UK, because the US is not the only country apparently getting a shiny new Apple headquarters. The Brits are also going to have a new Apple headquarters, though it is going to be less of a mothership and more like, I would describe it as a Wonka factory, which is really cool. There are reports that Apple plans to gather up about 14,000 employees from 8 offices around London and bring them together in a new office space being built in the decommissioned Battersea Power Station on the south bank of the River Thames. The site is something of an icon. It was built in the 1930s and has been featured on the cover of a Pink Floyd album and in the Beatles film Help. It's also been used in many other TV shows and films, including The Dark Knight and Children of Men, which I recently just watched on, I think it was HBO Now. And I saw the building after hearing about Apple setting up as a new headquarters in the UK. It's pretty impressive. Like I said, it reminds me of the chocolate factory from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. But the facility apparently has been undergoing a £9 billion redevelopment. And now Apple employees will occupy 500,000 square feet across six floors of the new central boiler house area, about 40% of the total office space for the whole development. So unlike the Spaceship Campus in Cupertino, Apple's not building this exclusively for themselves. It's actually a developer who's redeveloping that whole area. It's actually more than just office space. It's going to include new homes, offices, shops, entertainment, and outdoor spaces. So they're just taking up residence in a large portion of this main office building area, but still pretty impressive to see. And if you want to see what this thing looks like, just Google search Battersea Power Station and you'll see it, or, you know, pick up your Pink Floyd album and you'll see it there too. One of those things. And actually there was a little homage to this in the Children of Men episode or movie is on the Pink Floyd cover. They kind of floated this giant pink inflatable pig. I don't know exactly what that means. It was on the cover. And if you do, certainly send me some feedback, fill me in. But I guess that's part of this whole Battersea Power Station icon mythos now as well. Also in international news, some Apple Pay expansions. Apple Pay is now available in Russia. It's limited to MasterCard debit and credit cards issued through the Moscow Bank. Sberbank, hopefully I pronounced that right. And also, Taiwan's Financial Supervisory Commission is now taking applications from banks who want to offer Apple Pay. So it's looking like Apple Pay may be coming to Taiwan pretty soon. The platform could possibly be ready near the end of 2016, but it could be later. It's also said that at first, only credit cards are going to be supported on the platform in Taiwan. And then lastly, with Apple Pay, Kenya's biggest bank, KCB Group, is in talks with Apple and other mobile payment platforms like Facebook, Alibaba, Google, and Samsung and Apple Pay to bring those systems to that region as well. And then finally, I guess I lied. There's one more thing related to Apple Pay. Two more banks were added in the UK, the Cooperative Bank and Metro Bank. And then Apple is building a new Danish data center. It is a U.S. $950 million project announced back in 2015. Danish Foreign Minister Kirsten Jensen says it represents the largest foreign capital investment in the country's history. The facility will run on 100% renewable energy. And Apple has entered into an agreement with local university to actually fund research into biogas. So they're going to give them a grant to help fund that technology. The new facility is expected to be online next year and will support Apple services in Europe, like the iTunes Store, the App Store, iMessage, Apple Maps, and Siri. And then finally, in international news, the iPhone 7 launched in India. But it is super expensive. It will cost you roughly, with current exchange rates, about $898 US. And they're saying that's mostly due to local import taxes. And also, if you're in the Ukraine, iPhone has also gone on sale there. So once again, I lied. The last story in international news is the iPhone going on sale in the Ukraine. Few more odds and ends for you in this episode of the MacCast. Apple has stopped selling the third generation Apple TV. This was noticed by 9to5 Mac. They took it off the online store and reportedly sent an email to employees and to education partners explaining that the device has now reached end of life and has been discontinued. So you can kind of pick them up various places online for relatively cheaply. They're kind of going away. But if you want a new Apple TV, you're going to have to go for the latest fourth gen model. And then there was kind of a little controversy that happened over the last week or so. There's been this question, or it's been called into question, whether or not the iPhone lenses, the lenses on the new iPhone 7, are really sapphire. There was this YouTube video that showed scratching the lenses with some Mohs harden, I think that's how you pronounce it, Mohs hardness picks, basically these jeweler's picks that will detect the hardness of a material. And this whole controversy kind of caused Apple to go on a PR offensive. So if you've seen this video and you're questioning, you know, is my iPhone or are my iPhone lenses sapphire? Apple came out and they told iMore specifically, yes, absolutely, they're sapphire. They've always been sapphire. And they said, quote, under proper testing conditions, they achieve the hardness and purity results expected from sapphire. So in the video, they even actually confirm that it's sapphire. They do some chemical testing on them and they say, yep, absolutely, the material here is sapphire, but they're baffled why they're actually scratching them. And what it's looking like, and again, this is kind of alluded to in the video because they also look at the quote-unquote scratches under an electron microscope. What seems to be happening is the glass is extremely thin. The sapphire glass cover on that lens is extremely thin, and it appears to actually be fracturing under the pressure being applied by the pick. And that's what Apple is alluding to, where there's this uncontrolled pressure. There's not these conditions. And sapphire will crack. It's a brittle material. So what you're actually seeing is these micro cracks that look like a scratch, but they're really not a scratch. And there's no reason to believe that Apple is not using sapphire glass. It has been since the iPhone 5, and the glass has held up incredibly well on every iPhone, at least every iPhone that I've owned. I've never noticed or had an issue with scratching on the lens, and I don't expect with the iPhone 7 that anyone will as well. So why this thing even became kind of an issue is a little bit baffling, but you don't need to worry. Yes, it is sapphire. And then one last thing, DJ mixes have started to arrive on Apple Music thanks to a deal with a company called Dubset. And what this means is that DJs can now put together mixes, they can make them available on Apple Music. And what Dubset does is they have this cool audio fingerprinting technology that will go in, figure out what samples or what music tracks are in that mix, and appropriately define and pay out royalties to the artists whose works are used in those mixes. And that's what enabled Apple to actually bring DJ mixes to Apple Music. Now, as far as I know, there's only one track available now, but it's expected that we're going to get more of those. So if you're into DJ mixes, you now have a new reason to maybe sign up for and get Apple Music. And then the last thing that I have for you in the news for this week is this whole incident that happened with the App Store and a developer who makes an application called Dash. And I wasn't going to talk about this, but it just became too weird and confusing. And I want to make sure that we kind of clear things up, because there's a lot of information flying around from a bunch of different sources. But what I like to do on the MacCast is kind of pull it all together for you, present it so that you can hopefully more easily understand what's going on and all sides of it without kind of a bias towards one side or the other, and then decipher it. So what this relates to is the typical thing that it relates to when developers and the App Store clash, and that is the rules. We know that the App Store and its rules can often be daunting for developers, but this week something happened that was just truly, in my mind, baffling. It came to light, as I said, when the developer of this app called Dash, a guy named, and hopefully I'm not going to mutilate his name, but I'm sure I probably am, Bogdan Popescu of Capelli, he posted on his blog that Apple had suddenly, and seemingly without warning, but as you'll hear here in a bit, there actually was some warning, Apple suddenly and seemingly without warning removed his apps from the Mac App Store and the App Store and revoked his developer account without the chance for an appeal. They basically said, you're shut down. That's it. There's no appealing this. It's over. You can't sell your apps on the App Store, the Mac App Store, or the App Store. And that's particularly concerning because for his iOS app, he now has no way to sell it. For the Mac app, he can actually sell it through his store. And actually, just in case you are a user of Dash, I actually own the Dash application. He does have a process where you can transfer your Mac App Store license over to a license directly for the app from his website. So you're probably going to want to do that because it's looking at this point like Dash is not coming back to the App Store. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself there. So what happened was he wrote this blog post. And for those of you who don't know, Dash is a popular application for mainly developers. It allows developers to access different documentation for programming languages. So this is documentation that you typically find online through that language's website or organization that, you know, represents that language. But his app allows you to access that documentation through the app for literally hundreds of different, hundreds of different programming languages, at least close to hundreds of different programming languages. And then you can also do things like pull offline copies. So you can store it offline for future reference when you're not connected to the web. Or another advantage of the Dash app is it allows you to take code snippets and actually store those. And you can even invoke them with little keyboard shortcut commands, much in the same way you might do with a tool like, say, for example, TextExpander. But it's very developer coding programming language focused. It is a great app, and it's loved by many, many developers, which is another reason why I think this became such a big issue this week, because Apple was specifically kind of targeting and shutting down a developer who made a tool for other developers that a lot of them use. Probably even people inside Apple use Dash. I would not be surprised to learn this. So what happened was his account got revoked suddenly and seeming like, you know, for an unknown reason. But what actually turned out to be is that Apple released a statement explaining that the account had been canceled due to review fraud that they had discovered. And they claimed that the developer had been contacted. He had been warned many times. Apple said they tried working with him. The behavior didn't stop. So they ultimately decided to, or were forced to, shut down the account. Now, of course, the developer of Dash denied that he committed any review fraud and claimed that Apple never contacted him prior to shutting down the account, which I think happened last Friday. So as I'm recording this, last Friday. And when the story first broke, it seemed very odd to me. You know, when I heard this, I thought, this doesn't make any sense. Why would this developer commit review fraud? Because his app is extremely popular. A lot of us use it in the developer community and love it. So he wouldn't, I couldn't see any reason why he would have to commit review fraud to sort of pump up his app. It just didn't jive. It didn't make sense. So as the story is unfolding, different things are happening. And then over the weekend, Apple responded to the developer's blog post, basically, with a statement to The Loop. They told The Loop that they had detected almost 1,000 fraudulent reviews detected across what they said were two accounts and across 25 different apps that this developer was distributing. They said that warning was given in advance of the termination, that attempts were made to resolve the issue with the developer, but they were unsuccessful, so they ultimately had to shut down the account. They also said that this was something that was happening over a period of like 2 years. They had contacted this developer 2 years in advance and been unable to work anything out. So, hey, they had to shut down the account. What was odd about this statement, though, was that the Dash developer's account only has two apps associated with it, the Mac App Store app, and the iOS app. So what were these other sort of 20 apps that were being represented? So that was kind of the first thing that kind of gave a clue or gave an indication that there was something more to this story, I guess. And the clue to solving that mystery actually became clear after the statement was made to The Loop, because the developer posted another blog post along with an audio recording of a conversation that he had had with the Apple Worldwide Developer Relations, as they put it, at the direction of Phil Schiller. Phil was not happy about what was going on with this incident. He kind of wanted it to get resolved, and he asked apparently asked Apple Worldwide Developer Relations to kind of reach out to the developer. So they called him, and he recorded that conversation. And in that call, what Apple does is explain that the fraud was on an account they say was linked to the Capelli account, and that it was the linked account that committed the review fraud. And they also said that that was the person who was contacted about the fraud and who Apple had tried to work with to kind of get things cleaned up. The accounts, they say, were linked because the same credit card was used to pay for both accounts. And therefore, in Apple's eyes, they see the two accounts, the two accounts as a single legal entity. And so when they were unable to resolve the issues with the one account, they just shut all accounts that were linked to together. And one of those accounts was this account from the Dash developer. Now, Bogdan explains in the blog post, and if you listen to the call, on the call itself, that the linked account is apparently a relative who he had helped set up with a developer account by paying for it, and that he provided some of his older testing devices that he wasn't using to that person, and that's sort of how the accounts became linked. So that's that part of the mystery. And he also explains, and Apple confirms, that he was never contacted directly and he was unaware of any of the fraud issues. Otherwise, he would have worked to try and resolve them. So apparently, when Apple sent out the communication saying, hey, we're going to shut down your account, you're doing review fraud, that email went to this relative. Bogdan was completely unaware that that was actually going on. And so what Apple's trying to do in the call is actually resolve this whole issue. They're kind of doing the right thing. They've reached out to the developer and they're saying, hey, we want to clear this up. We want to get you reinstated, but we want you to do some things. We know you wrote this blog post. We want you to write another blog post. And this is the conversation they're having, right? They're talking about, okay, here's how we're going to go about getting you reinstated. And so they explain that they want him to write this blog post. And in the blog post, they want him to make it clear that three things are stated or understood. One, that he understands that his account was linked to the account with the fraudulent activity. Two, that he is working with Apple to unlink the two accounts, or to get his account unlinked from the other account. And three, that he's working with Apple to get back in the program, meaning the developer program. And they say, if you do this blog post and you state these three things, then, you know, we'll clear this all up. We'll get you reinstated. Interestingly, in the call, although they don't say he has to write about this, Apple is also adamant to the developer that they did not make a mistake in canceling the account. They say a couple times, hey, we want to make sure you understand we did not make a mistake here. Us canceling the account was the right thing to do given our rules and the way we operate and how we try to protect our customers and all that sort of thing. And ultimately, at the end of the call, Bogdan agrees, okay, I will write up this blog post. His main concern is he wants to have it be clear that he hasn't done anything wrong on his account. And they say, that's fine. Just make it clear that there was a linked account and that the linked account was doing the fraudulent activity. You don't have to say that you committed fraud, but that you know and understand that this linked account was where the fraud was going on, and that's how things got shut down. So everything seems to be going great after this phone call, right? Everything's amicable. Apple's ready to reinstate the account. The developer's happy. He agrees to write the blog post, and as a matter of fact, he says in a follow-up blog post, he sent it to Apple about 30 minutes after the end of this phone call. But then the baffling press release to the loop happens, because this happens after the developer has already sent his version of the blog post over to Apple. And once again, in the loop statement, it mentions that there are two accounts, but it doesn't really adequately explain all of the facts that, you know, one of these accounts is a linked account. The statement to the loop seems to imply fault on the part of Bogdan and Compelli. And it's at that point that Bogdan goes public with the details in the phone call. So the timeline of this whole thing is Apple shuts down the account. There's an uproar from the community. Apple contacts the developer through Worldwide Developer Relations. They have this conversation. Bogdan agrees to write this blog post. He sends Apple the blog post to kind of approve and confirm. And then Apple releases this weird statement to the loop that sort of pins the blame back on, not directly, you know, if you read it, they mention the two accounts, but it sort of still kind of points the blame at Bogdan, the developer of Dash. And then after that, Bogdan releases this phone call to try and clear his name, blah, blah, blah. And now we're at the point we're at now, which is it looks like the developer is not going to get his account reinstated. And Apple has sort of washed their hands of the whole affair. They're kind of done with it. So the last thing that I want to talk about is that, or the last few things I want to talk about is, one, what happened? You know, why did Apple, which it seemed was on its way to a good resolution, sabotage this whole, you know, positive PR coup that they could have been on with this statement to the loop? And the only thing I can speculate is that they were not happy with the blog post that Bogdan wrote. He put up a copy. It's up now on his blog. I'll link to it in the show notes at metcast.com. But in it, he really, I mean, if you read it, he really didn't hit the 3 points, at least not directly, that Apple wanted him to hit. He mentions that Apple is going to reactivate his account, but doesn't mention specifically that he's working with Apple to reactivate his account. He doesn't really mention that he understands that there was a linked account and that the linked account was doing fraud. He just says that his account wasn't involved in ratings or review fraud, and that he did help a developer get into the program a few years ago and handed them testing equipment, which he said looked to Apple like he was responsible for both accounts. And that he does mention in there that the other developer was involved in the review manipulation and that both accounts got shut down. But that's about it. He kind of doesn't hit three specific points. So it could be that Apple was upset about that and decided, that's it, we're just going straight to the press and we're gonna air sort of, or give our side directly to them. So I'm guessing that because of that, that's where Apple kind of felt that, all right, we're ready to burn this bridge and we're ready to get off the high road. They basically leaped off the high road at that point. And now it's this whole incident of, you know, Apple versus the developer. And again, the developer for sure did not help his situation after that happened, after the statement came out, by going public with the recording of the phone call. I can tell you right now, Apple does not like that sort of thing. So finally, you know, what do I think about this? Why does all of this matter? Why are we having this conversation? I think it matters because this looks like Apple, I think, being heavy-handed with a small developer, and a big part of Apple's business is built on the hard work of their developers. And many developers are rallying behind Bogdan and Dash in this little sort of scuffle that's been going on, or this little dust-up. And to be honest, we'll never know for sure if what Bogdan claims is true. Was this just a case of him helping out a relative who then kind of did some things on this linked account that caused the whole shutdown to happen? Or was this some, you know, or is this actually some sort of scam and he's actually behind both accounts? There's no way for us to know or prove that one way or the other. Now, I'm actually willing to take him at his word. I believe him. I believe that Bogdan helped a relative and this is what happened. And Apple seems to have been willing to believe that too. They were obviously working with him. So my hope now, I guess, is that Apple would get back on the high road and still work with the developer to reinstate his account, even if they had to do it at a probationary level. I mean, they could come back in and say, look, we don't know what's going on. We can't prove specifically that you were committing this fraud, but we're willing to reinstate your account for Dash and let you get that back up and running. We're going to monitor it closely. We're going to keep an eye on it. Assuming you don't have any more problems, we're happy to let you keep going. And I think that's what they should do. I don't think they are going to do that. If they did, I think they would come off looking like the hero in this situation. But my concern is that they won't, because they're too concerned that taking the high road in this situation might make them look like they're admitting to this mistake. Again, remember that phone call? They kept really trying to drive home that Apple did not make a mistake in shutting down this account. So if they allow it to be reinstated at this point, after everything that's happened, in some ways it might show that they're saying, hey, we are at least partially culpable in what happened here. And to be clear, I think mistakes were made on both sides, and that both sides should actually share some of the blame. I don't think, you know, Apple did everything right here, but Apple can be stubborn on these points. They don't want, they highly control their image and they don't want to look bad. So, you know, if they don't get this resolved, if they don't choose to kind of take that higher road and work with this developer and get them back reinstated, I hope at the very least that what Apple takes away from this and what they learn is that they need to treat accounts that are linked still like they might be from separate people. I think it's been proven that you can have linked accounts that may be wholly separate people. And if they're going to get to a situation where they're going to need to shut down every account that's linked together because there's some sort of issue like fraud or whatever it might be, that they change their policy, their notification policy, and notify all of the linked accounts individually that there's going to be an impending shutdown, so that everybody that's a participant in those linked accounts is aware that there is a problem. I really think this should have already been in place like this. I don't know why it wasn't, but I really hope in light of this incident that it's the new policy moving forward. And I have a feeling that it will be. You know, again, usually what happens with the App Store is some sort of issue like this comes up and they go through an event and then there's changes that are made to help avoid a similar kind of situation in the future. I think Apple's smart about that. But as far as what's going to happen with Bogdan, Dash, and Capelli, I think they're not going to be back on the App Store. And the really unfortunate part about this is that anybody who bought the iOS app is kind of at... they've lost something because they're not going to have access to that app anymore. They're not going to get updates. It's sort of dead. There's no way for the developer to re-release the iOS app. Luckily, the Mac app can continue on. You're just going to have to get it directly from the website. And as I mentioned already, if you do currently have a license, you want to go to the website and you want to transfer your license over. So that's kind of what's happening with that. Big mess. But hopefully that kind of gives you all sides and helps you understand the whole situation a little bit better. If you have any comments on this, you have something you want to add, an opinion, a thought, whatever it might be, feel free to send that in. Send me an audio comment. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. We're going to follow up on a couple of items that we covered on past episodes of the MacCast, starting off with the whole Fujitsu ScanSnap issue with macOS Sierra. You may remember that there was, if you own a Fujitsu ScanSnap scanner and have been scanning things to PDF with that, specifically using the ScanSnap organizer software that Fujitsu announced, don't upgrade to macOS Sierra. We've got a problem that could result in data loss in some of your files in certain instances. And they had kind of put everybody in a holding pattern if you wanted to upgrade to Sierra. Well, they announced plans this week for their updates. As a matter of fact, there's already an update out, came out October 6th, with new versions of ScanSnap Manager and CardMinder for owners of ScanSnap models iX500, iX100, SV600, and S1300i, as well as S1100i. So you can now get that software and download it for your ScanSnap if you have one of those models. Now, it's important to note that this is not a full fix, so you may or may not want to still hold off on upgrading to macOS Sierra, because they say the fixes only work for new scans moving forward and that it will not resolve issues with PDF files previously created by ScanSnap, nor address the problems with the ScanSnap organizer on previously scanned files. The updated apps will soon be available for owners of ScanSnap models S1500, S1500M, S1300, S1100, that's supposed to come out on October 17th, and the ScanSnap Evernote edition, they say, will be updated by the end of October. What they don't talk about, though, is what about older ScanSnap models? I specifically have like a 300M, and I don't even know if the software will be updated for that. So a lot of us are still kind of up in the air. They do say that they're continuing to work on the problem already affecting, or that's affecting already created PDFs, but they don't have a time frame for that fix. So what I read into this is if you own a ScanSnap, there is new software coming out that'll help you if you want to make new scans. But if you're like me and you have an entire paperless workflow that's built on the back of a ScanSnap scanner, you may want to hold off. I would say, you know, more specifically, go to Fujitsu's website and read about the specific details of these issues, because they may not be a problem for you. You know, if you look at the specifics and decide, you know, I'm not worried about that, that's not a problem for me, then you probably can still upgrade and move forward. I personally am still a little bit leery about it. I may do some testing with copies on a separate system just to see if my workflows are unaffected. But it's a little bit scary. You know, the idea of having data loss on the hundreds, if not thousands, potential data loss on the hundreds, if not thousands of items that I've scanned over the years is a little bit scary, I have to be honest. I also want to follow up a little bit on the two-factor authentication stuff that I talked about. I mentioned last time that with macOS Sierra, it's probably time to move to two-factor authentication, especially if you've been using the older two-step verification system from Apple. And the reason for that is that if you wanted to use the new unlock feature, unlock your Mac with your Apple Watch feature, you're required to have enabled two-factor authentication on your iCloud account. Also, if you want to control HomeKit devices from outside your home network through a fourth-generation Apple TV hub, you need to be using two-factor authentication on your iCloud account. The thing that I want to follow up on this week is that I forgot to mention a couple of gotchas in doing this. The first being that some people are finding that even if they disable two-step verification, they are unable to enable two-factor authentication on their accounts. It actually happened to our friend Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer. He cannot get two-factor authentication turned on for his iCloud account. And there's no logical reason why. Apple support has been contacted. They are aware of an issue, a bug that affects some limited iCloud accounts and their ability to turn on two-factor authentication. They're looking to correct the issue, but they don't have any word on when that might happen. And I had at least one of you email me after that episode aired where we talked about the two-factor authentication and you were also suffering from this problem. So I know it's not totally isolated to just Jeff Gamet. Other people are hit by this. So I wanted to make everybody aware of that. Also, if you like the option of using your iCloud login as your Mac login, then you should know that once you enable two-factor authentication under macOS Sierra, that's no longer an option. You actually cannot use that feature if you turn on two-factor authentication. So you're going to have to weigh the pluses and minuses and decide, do I want to use my iCloud login as my Mac login? And you may or may not have been aware that that actually is something that you can do in OS X or macOS Sierra, but it is. And if you want to continue to use that option, then you won't be able to use two-factor authentication. For me personally, I'd opt to use two-factor authentication because of the security aspects of it, and just switch to, you know, using a local login for your Mac account rather than just your single iCloud login. But just wanted to follow up on those two things and make you aware of some gotchas, potential gotchas with two-factor authentication and setting that up. And then another thing that I asked you for was some feedback on how your iPhone 7 upgrades went. And you may or may not have thought that, wow, my iPhone 7 upgrade was tricky, but I bet you it was not as tricky for you as it was for Ray. Ray wrote in and gave me a somewhat harrowing tale of an iPhone 7 upgrade. You see, Ray is visually impaired and he relies on VoiceOver for access to his device. And what he mentioned to me was that he was using an enhanced high-quality voice, which is something that you can enable. You can enable through the accessibility settings, through the voice settings. Apple has these enhanced voices that are a little bit better quality. You actually have to download them from Apple's servers when you activate them. And a lot of people who use VoiceOver like to use these higher quality voices. And so Ray was doing that. But what he discovered during this iPhone 7 upgrade was apparently the enhanced voices do not restore as part of your backup. So when you're setting the phone back up and you restore from backup, the voice does not come back over. The setting, though, does seem to come back over, and that causes a problem because in Ray's instance, he was using the enhanced U.S. English voice, Tom, and after restoring, when the lock screen came up and asked him to enter in his, or tried to ask him to enter in his passcode, he was not getting any voice feedback. So he'd put his finger on the screen, and all he would hear is the click of his finger landing on some button, but having no idea what that button might be. So as you can imagine, it's kind of hard to log in or put in your passcode when you don't know what number your finger's on. Now, luckily, he was able to use some muscle memory and sliding and counting, kind of hearing the number of clicks. He could figure out which number he was on and then was able to tap the number. Because when you have VoiceOver activated, when you select an element, it sort of gets a little selection put around it. And then you can just simply tap anywhere on the screen. And that will actually act as, or double tap, I think, anywhere on the screen. And that will actually act as a click, as if you had clicked on that or tapped on that button. And so he was able to actually get in, and then once he was able to get in, he could leave his iPhone connected to his Mac. It was unlocked. He could do all the syncing. He could get all the information back onto his device and get the voices reactivated. So just a little gotcha if you're in that situation that you might want to be aware of. Yeah. Kind of a rough upgrade for Ray, but I'm glad, Ray, that you got it sorted out. And I certainly did get a lot of great feedback on iPhone 7s and the upgrades. Unfortunately, you know, I don't have time to go through it all here on the show and play it all out, but I wanted to play another comment that I received from Danny.
Hey, Adam. This is Danny from Arkansas. Hey, just got done listening to the MacCast this week. Enjoyed your co-hosts and their perspective on things. Sometimes people think I'm a little picky, and I wonder if I'm a little crazy, but after hearing their perspective on things, it made me feel a lot better. I really enjoyed that. Hey, wanted to comment on the iPhone 7. A couple episodes ago, you talked a lot about it, especially the removal of the headphone jack. You had mentioned how that, for the next couple years, there's going to be a lot of pain you know, and the transformation here. And I agree with you. So me and my wife were both up for an upgrade, and her battery actually was doing pretty bad. So decided to upgrade hers first. But for our needs, everybody has their own needs. But for our needs, we decided to go with an iPhone 6S. I'm probably going to get the 6S Plus myself. But we had 6s and 6 pluses before that. And we're getting, you know, a pretty good upgrade. We get the 3D touch and the better camera, the faster processor, everything from what we have. Of course, it's not quite as good as the 7. The only thing about the 7 that blows me away is the camera. The 7 Plus camera would be wonderful. I'd love to have it. But I can't live without the headphone jack. And I don't really agree with them taking it out. Now, some people think it's an all or nothing deal. Like, you're either for the old analog technology or you're for the new digital technology. Well, I totally disagree. I'm all for the new technology, but the old technology is still here, and I feel like it's still going to be here for a while. Just about every device in the world that's an audio device will let you plug in using a 3.5 millimeter jack. So I hate to lose that functionality. Now, the new functionality is great. Be able to plug in through the Lightning port, that's fine. We have Lightning ports on, you know, all the latest phones. Bluetooth, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the last couple of iPhones, the 6s and 6 pluses, or 6s's, they have the same Bluetooth as the 7, so, hey, we've got the latest stuff. We just have to buy the new devices, the new headphones. That's what's going to give us the new audio quality, the new connectivity, from what I understand. So to me, getting the 6S phones or 6S pluses are giving you the best audio of all. You get the digital, Bluetooth, and you still have the old standby analog jack, which simply just works. There's no fooling with it. It just plug in and go. So anyway, the 6 and 6, or the 6S will be our upgrade option. And, that's what was going to work for us. Everybody's different. Hey, thanks for the show. Love listening. Have a great day.
Hey, Danny, thank you so much for your comments and your feedback. And, you know, I think that's great. I want to share another thing. After Danny sent me this voicemail, he also sent another really quick one. And I'm just going to summarize because it kind of points out a good reason why you might want to have a 3.5 millimeter jack. He went to a friend's, I think it was anniversary. I put here it was a wedding story, but it was actually an anniversary, I think a 30th year anniversary, good friend. And the daughter came up and said, hey, do you happen to remember what song was played at my parents' wedding? Because I want to play that song so that they can dance to it. And he actually remembered the song and sure enough had it on his iPhone and was able to take it to the sound system there at the event and actually plug it in using, guess what, a 3.5 millimeter jack. And had he had an iPhone 7, yeah, maybe he would have had the adapter with him, but chances are probably most of us aren't carrying around. I'll admit, I'm not, unless I have my laptop bag with me, I'm not carrying around on a day-to-day basis my Lightning 3.5 millimeter jack. So, you know, that's one incident where, as I mentioned before, there's going to be a transitionary period as we're moving from one technology to the other. Now, the event could have had a Bluetooth speaker system or some other way of connecting, but in this particular scenario, they only had the 3.5 millimeter jack. So I'm with you, Danny. I think that if that jack is really important to you and you're upgrading from an older model phone, an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus or older, looking at the iPhone 6S as an option or the 6S Plus as an upgrade option is a great idea. You're absolutely right. They still have a lot of the same great technology in them. The camera is kind of one of the bigger things. Of course, the new A10 Fusion processor and some of the performance stuff is another thing. But, you know, they're still very capable phones. And yes, of course, they have the 3.5 millimeter jack. So if it's a deal breaker for you, I think absolutely look at that model. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with upgrading from an iPhone 5 to a 6S, even though the 7 is the latest and greatest thing that Apple has to offer right now. Plus, you save a little bit of money, right? So there's a good option there all the way around. And I certainly appreciate your comments and your feedback. Another thing that I've talked quite a bit about on a few episodes of the MacCast recently, I think, is Apple's investment in AI technologies and where we're starting to see that creep into some of our actual products in terms of Siri, in terms of some of the other features. And one of those areas that it's creeped into is the Photos application, both on the Mac and on iOS. And where you'll see this most prominently is in things like the faces recognition, the new content recognition, or sort of auto tagging feature where you can search for things that are inside your photos. Apple's actually scanning and using artificial intelligence local on the device to actually create a database of what's in those images and make them searchable. It's amazing technology. If you haven't played around with it, and I think I've mentioned this a few times, I'm going to drive it home again in this episode. If you haven't tested it out, if you haven't played with it, play with it. You'll be blown away. And another area where this is being applied in Photos is in the new Memories album. And if you haven't played around with the Memories album, I encourage you to check that out too. It's pretty cool. And Gary was poking around and looking at the Memories and discovered something he wanted to share with us.
Hey, Adam, it's Gary. I wanted to tell you about something I found. It may not be, I guess, maybe super secret, but I thought it was interesting. It wasn't abundantly clear when I first got started with Moments that you could really customize things. Part of what I thought was not so great about making little videos and things inside of iMovie and sending them to people is the choices for music were really limited. And I know I could go on my own personal collection, iTunes, and pick something, but oftentimes my music is not the best for like a family video or a special event video that you want to share with somebody. You need something maybe that is no lyrics or something like that, no voices. You want it to be upbeat. So in Moments, Apple has different categories of the music that matches the categories you choose in Moments when you do get a moment created for you, that you can go from happy, or I think it's upbeat, or epic. So it chooses music by default. I didn't know that after I've created many, many of the same happy videos that you could really go in there and you can select from, I think each one of them has like 20 different selections. Some of them need to be downloaded to your phone. I think it's questionable whether that frees up space when it needs to, stuff like that, but you click download and there's a lot of choices in there and they're really good. So I thought that was surprising. I have not checked to see if those are also accessible in iMovie if you're creating something independent and you want to add some different audio tracks. And these tracks that it has in there are very much what you would want to be underneath like a video, a photo montage or something like that. So I thought I would share it. And there you go. Thanks.
Hey, Gary. Thanks as always for sharing that. Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things that is not necessarily easy to discover where you kind of tweak this stuff. So I thought I'd dig into this a little bit deeper. But before I do that, I do want to make one clarification because wonderful Apple and their close together naming conventions and terminology. The feature that you're talking about is actually called Memories. It's the Memories tab or the Memories section of the Photos app. Moments is actually sort of that main library, which Apple separates into, I think it starts out as years, and then as you drill in, becomes collections, and then becomes Moments. So just so we don't confuse the two things. So we're talking about Memories here, and this is the thing where Apple uses its AI technology to kind of pull together and create these little kind of photo slideshows for you automatically around different events and different time periods and things like that based on the photos that are in your collection. So it might be centered around a certain trip, a collection of those photos, or the last 3 months, best photos from the last 3 months, or these sorts of things. And it does it all automatically in the background, puts these things together, and then you can tap on them And then it plays this little slideshow, which has music and transitions and puts your photos together and can recognize faces and knows how to zoom in and do all the Ken Burns effect and stuff for you automatically. And it's really cool. That's kind of a one-button click thing, and you have this cool little montage. But as Gary pointed out, there's actually some customizations you can do to this, including changing the audio or sort of the theme, the mood of that memory. And the way you do it is, as it's playing, if you simply tap on that memory, it will bring up some additional options. And that's where you'll see, like Gary mentioned, the different music, where you can slide back and forth and you can switch between things like some gentle music or some happy music or some uplifting music. They've got club music. They've got extreme music. So depending upon what the memory is and the kinds of images that are associated with it, you may want to change the whole mood of that. It also changes, like, the font that's used for the text at the beginning of the moment, the title of it and stuff like that. So you can play around with that. And that's pretty cool. Also underneath that, if you have enough images in it, you can either cut down the length of that memory or you can make it longer. So you can go from short to medium to long. And again, what options you'll see for the length have to do with how many images or videos are cobbled together or assembled together in that memory. And that's pretty cool as well. But what you may or may not also notice as you're, you know, in that section, so again, you've tapped, you've started playing a memory, and then you've tapped on that, now you see these additional options. There's actually a little settings icon. It looks like three little kind of sliders, and if you tap on that, you can get even more detailed options. You can change things like the title. You can tap on the title, and not only can you change the title, actually what it says on the screen at the beginning of the memory, but you can also select the title style. So you can go in there and tap the style that you want. In there, you'll also find the music selections, the soundtracks. And if you tap through into that, you'll see what Gary was referring to as all the different kinds of music that you can pick. So it's not only that you can say, I want this to have happy music. There's actually several different tracks of happy music, and you can download some additional ones, or dreamy music, or chill music, whatever kind that you want. And you can find the one that's perfect for that memory, and you can specifically select it. I noticed in mine that there's also the ability to select my music, but in my case, it's grayed out. And I think that might be because I use Apple Music and I don't have music loaded locally on the phone. You might have to have it downloaded and actually stored locally on the phone for that to become available. Either that, or maybe it has to do with the length or the number of images that are in that memory. I'm not really sure. I'm going to have to dig into that a little bit more. If you happen to know, shoot me an email. Let me know, mattcast@gmail.com. You can tweak the duration, so you can actually sort of control the sliders and set the minutes and seconds you want for that. Again, that'll be determined somewhat by the number of photos or videos that's in that memory. And then also there's a photos and videos section that you can tap on, and you can actually adjust and control the individual images and videos that are in that memory. So you can tap the little plus button and you can add additional photos and videos to it, or you can select on one of the items that are in the timeline and then tap on the trash can, or you can actually slide through to an individual image or video, tap the trash can icon, and actually remove it. Now, one thing I noticed when I was playing around with this is the system, I think, to adjust for length, if you've deleted too many images, it will actually randomly, or I guess using the AI, try and throw in additional images so it can get to the proper length. So just be aware of that, because I was kind of noticing, hey, I deleted this image, but now there's this new image in here that I don't like. And so you kind of need to make sure that, you know, if it has 37 items in it and the thing that it auto-created, you probably want to make sure that it has 37 items in it when you manually adjust what's in there. So just be aware of that. But you can totally control and set up those moments. And then finally, the last thing to be aware of is that as you're playing the moment and you tap, there actually is a share icon. So you can even share and export the video in a number of different ways, the little slideshow along with the audio and everything else. You can send it as an iMessage, as an email attachment, send it to Facebook or Instagram or Twitter if you want to share that. You also get the option to actually save the video to your device. And I noticed when I saved mine to iCloud, it actually created a 1080p video from that memory. You can also save it to iCloud and a bunch of other sources. And then finally, you can also, if you have an Apple TV, you can actually AirPlay it directly to your Apple TV from the share menu. So it's pretty neat and powerful feature that's built right into iOS 10. I've kind of described how you manage it in iOS 10. I haven't played around yet with it yet on macOS. I know they're in there. I would imagine the sort of managing, editing, and changing the mood and the theme and all these settings is very similar on the Mac as well. But thanks, Gary, for noticing that and sending in that tip. And then the last thing that I have for you this week is a tip or a trick on how to use the digital touch feature in iOS 10. iOS 10 brings digital touch to the Messages app. This is a feature that first appeared on the Apple Watch. And the trouble that I've had with it on iOS 10 is the crazy little hieroglyphic images, help images that it shows when you go into the digital touch interface that are supposedly explaining exactly how to use each style or kind of digital touch, to me is a little bit confusing. It kind of makes sense, but it's not really all that clear. So I thought it'd be good to kind of cover in this episode how you use digital touch on iOS 10 in iMessage. And the first thing to know is how do you get to digital touch to actually be able to use the feature. So you open up iMessage, you start a new conversation, or you go into an existing one. And then right there next to the text entry box, what you'll notice is you have the app icon now for the new iMessage app store. And then right next to that, there's a little heart with these two stylized, I think they're supposed to be fingers, but they almost just look like two little bars. It's a kind of a strange looking icon, but that is the digital touch. I think it's supposed to be two fingers because that's one of the gestures you can do with it. And once you're in the digital touch interface, what you'll notice is you kind of have a square area that's almost like a trackpad. It's the touch area. And then you have those little hieroglyphics on the right that are supposedly showing you the different kinds of digital touches that you can send. And then you have kind of a color palette over on the left-hand side. And the reason you have that palette is because you can use some different colors for some of the different kinds of digital touch or digital touches, I guess, that you can do. And you have a few options. You have sketches, you have taps, kisses, heartbeats, broken hearts, and fireballs, or I think what one of the websites that I follow called Angry Fireballs. I kind of like the Angry Fireballs thing, so we'll go with that. You can shoot angry fireballs at your friends through iMessage. So how do you access and use all of these things? Well, let's start off with sketches. These are actually surprisingly the most straightforward of the digital touches, I think. When you pull up digital touch, if in that main touch area you just start drawing with one finger, it will follow your finger and you can make little drawings. You can tap on the colors over on the color palette over on the left-hand side to actually change colors. You have just a few choices there. And I think if you tap and hold on one of the colors, actually, this is something you can do on the Apple Watch, and I think this will work as well in digital touch on iOS. If you tap and hold on it, I think you can get a color picker. No, and I'm being proven wrong on that. Oh, no, yes, you can. So I was just trying this on my phone. You can actually bring up a color picker and select from a full palette. So tap and hold on a color to do that. But right off the bat, you get kind of a basic palette of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 colors to work with. And you can change colors, you can add multiple colors to your drawing, and then when you're done, you can tap on the little blue up arrow to send that, and it will kind of play it back for the person who's receiving the message. They can kind of see how you did your drawing and switch between the colors and stuff like that. And that's pretty cool. If you started a drawing and you really don't like it, you can tap the little X and simply cancel out of the drawing. And that's important to note, because a lot of the other digital touches, as you will see, the minute that you do them, it actually sends them. You don't get that opportunity to kind of cancel out of it. So that's sketches. Now for taps, these are pretty simple as well. You simply just tap on the screen. It will create this little ring that starts out big and gets smaller and smaller and smaller and kind of fades away. Or it might start small and get bigger. I might be getting that backwards now. I'm just going to try it. So it starts out big and it gets smaller and smaller until it fades away. And then when it gets to the smallest point, it actually sends it. Now I'm mentioning that because if you're really quick when you're doing the taps, you can actually select another color. So you have the color palette on the left-hand side. That's the color that it will create the tap in when you tap on the phone. If you're really fast, you can tap on the color palette, select another color, and tap again before the tap ring fades all the way out and before the message gets sent, and you can send multicolored taps to someone. It's a little bit tricky to do. It's almost like a little bit of a game, but play around with that and see if you can do it. So that is taps. And I believe on the receiving side, the receiver will actually feel the taps coming through as vibrations using the Taptic engine on their device or Apple Watch. Then you have kisses. Again, these are somewhat straightforward. You tap, but you just do it with two fingers, and the hieroglyph kind of explains that to you, and that will send a little set of lips, I guess a kiss, to another person. I actually sent a couple of these to Barry Falk the first time I was trying to figure out how to use the digital touch features. I think he thought that was very sweet of me to send him a kiss. But that's how you do that. And then you also have the heartbeat in the broken heart. And the way you do a heartbeat is you tap and then hold on the digital touch area with your fingers, and you will see a heart beating. And the longer that you hold down, the more beats you will send. And then when you lift your fingers is actually when the message gets sent. If you want to do a broken heart, it's a similar gesture. You tap and hold to get the heartbeat going. And then if you simply pull down, the heart will break. And I think as the heart breaks is actually when the message is sent for a broken heartbeat. So that's kind of sad. And then the last gesture, digital touch that you can do is the angry fireball. This is the one that I've actually had the most trouble doing. For some reason, I can't ever get this gesture right. But what you do is you tap and hold with one finger. I found that it helps to kind of do it in one swift motion. I have more luck getting it to work that way. Or if you have a device with 3D touch, if you just tap and kind of force press on the screen you'll get the flaming angry fireball. And once again, the fireball is sent when you lift your finger off of the screen. So that's all the new digital touch features that are in iMessage in iOS 10. Play around with those and let me know what you think. And then as promised, I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. It is the Anker Sound Sync Drive. So we've talked about this a few times, but the loss of the headphone jack on the iPhone 7, for me, the biggest area where it's become kind of a hassle is in my car. For connectivity in my car, for my iPhone, I've always used the auxiliary jack on my car stereo. And so plugging in from the headphone jack on my iPhone into my stereo was how I got audio into my car. And that's how I listen to podcasts and music and all that stuff. And so without having that anymore on my iPhone, it's been a little bit frustrating. And yes, I could use the Lightning to 3.5 millimeter adapter, and that would work just fine. But then I can't charge my phone in the car and use audio at the same time, which charging is something I often do in my car, and it's something I often rely on, especially if I'm on a long trip and I'm using GPS and all these other things. So I could spend about $80 and replace the head unit in my car, the stereo in my car, and get one that has Bluetooth support. But I'm cheap. You know, what can I say? On certain things, I'm cheap, and I perfectly like the car stereo that's in my car now. The only issue is connectivity on my iPhone. So I found and I opted for the Anki SoundSync Drive, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at MacCast.com. It costs US $21.99 on Amazon, so $22, not too expensive. And what it is it's a small Bluetooth transmitter. It looks like a little puck, just not much larger, I would say, than the charging cable for my Apple Watch. It's got, you know, a round circle on one end, and then a cable that comes down, and then that cable splits off into a Y. And it has a USB jack and a 3.5 millimeter jack. So what you do is you plug the 3.5 millimeter jack into the auxiliary in your stereo, plug the USB into your car's USB power adapter, which is not included, by the way, just to be clear. You can get one of those from Anker. They sell those separately. And then you put the little puck. It has a little peel-off sticky back, and then you can put the puck anywhere up on your dashboard where it will be convenient, because what's on the puck is a microphone for hands-free calling. It has a button so you can use it to activate, you know, press and hold and activate Siri as if you had pressed the home button. And then it has forward and back skip controls. So if you want to skip quickly through your music, you can put it up there. So put it up somewhere conveniently located where it's going to be able to pick up your voice commands, and also you'll have access to some of the button clicking features. And it works awesome. It's worked great for me so far. I do have a small issue with the volume of Siri when I'm getting voice feedback from Siri, but that's an iOS thing. You can't control that volume separately, so it's not necessarily the adapter's fault. The adapter works great. The microphone picks up the sound of my voice great. I haven't done a hands-free voice call on it yet, but I expect that to work out just fine just based on the reviews and some of the comments. This was actually recommended to me by another listener, and it's been great for navigation and music. I have no complaints at all. I use it for podcasts. I use it for using Siri to respond to with voice to my text messages and things like that. I know there are other adapters and solutions out there, so if you have another one that's your favorite, shoot us a quick review or pass it along, mattcast@gmail.com. But for me, the Anker SoundSync Drive is the perfect in-car solution for anyone who's got an iPhone 7 or iPhone 7 Plus and doesn't want to invest or doesn't have a stereo that has built-in Bluetooth. So check it out, $22 on Amazon. And again, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, as well as PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, or if you have some feedback, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281 622 4269-281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me online between shows, if you're on social media, you want to interact with other members of the MacCast community, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or if you prefer Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community, and you will find that at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.